Hello, and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex, who have we got on today?
I'm really excited today. So, as part of our African American History Week, we had Zeli Rainey Orr with us, who is a businesswoman, a historian of African American history, a writer, and an award-winning poet. She's also a Mississippi native and a veteran of the civil rights movement. Hi, Zeli.
Hi, Alex and Elena.
How are you doing today? You're just telling us, so we're actually recording this just as John Lewis's funeral is taking place, aren't we?
Yes, quite emotional for me because it was John Lewis who, in the 1960s, actually was at the forefront of organizing SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And myself, when I got to march at age 13 in 64 as a part of SNCC, it was because of John Lewis opening that door.
And he simply was a giant. We're going to tell your story today. So I guess we start with you grew up in Indianola, Mississippi. What do you remember of segregation?
I remember that, everything was about the colored and well, the signs that let us know where whites were permitted and colors, but more so going to the theater because there again, segregated facility, blacks went upstairs and whites went downstairs. And I always wondered why I had to get my refreshments outside in the weather when whites that we could see in the lobby could get theirs, comfortably and in the weather in a good way, and we could not. So I remember that distinctively about the segregated facilities.
And your elementary school was segregated, wasn't it?
It was.
So that was it a completely different school?
Yeah, it was a completely different school in the county. There were the black school for African Americans, obviously, and the one for whites. And at the white school, Asian Americans went, or Asians went to that school, but blacks only went to the black school. And it was also elementary through high school. We did not, well, it was two different schools, but we did not have a middle school. So first through eighth, and at the time I went to school, was elementary. And ninth through 12th was high school.
Did you have any contact at all with white children when you were small?
I did. In 1967, specifically on February 20th, 1967, myself and eight others integrated the high school and the junior high school. So, midterm, school would start in August of 66. But somehow we were the ones selected that in February of 67, we were told that we had to go to the white school. Three would enroll at the junior high school. Now, the whites had a junior high school, so we desegregated the white school. So the black kids, three went to eighth grade, junior high. Five of us went to the high school, and one went to the white elementary school.
Do you remember what it was like to walk into that school full of white children and how they reacted to you?
Well, it was definitely not pleasant. No one actually, there were, at least for me, I didn't have an encounter physically, except in the lunchroom, and I stopped going because when we sat down with our trays, somebody would throw something. You might get a spitball, and you look up, and the kids just laugh, so you never knew where it was coming from, even to just maybe say something to them about stopping. But what I remember the most is that we were given brand new books when we went to the white school. I was informed on a Friday that Monday, February 20th, we would be at the white school. So even though we were in the same county, our books were different for the same subject. So when I entered the white school, it was as if I was a brand new student. However, I was treated as if I had been there forever. I mean, no one took the time to say what page we're on, anything like that. And truly, we really were not welcome, but we were there.
As a little girl, did you have any inkling of this being something that you wanted to fight?
I did not. I really, deep within, was praying and hoping I was going to make friends with white kids, that they would see that I was not so bad, and perhaps that I was not a dumb person. And I really was hoping that I would make a difference in the community. that white kids would become friends with me.
It just for me, so to tell you on a Friday that come next Monday you would be going to a different school, that's hard enough for a high school kid. But it doesn't strike me that you got any time to mentally prepare for the confrontation that you were going to walk into, or that anybody much cared how you were going to deal with it emotionally.
Exactly. I mean, and we didn't know we were going to be going, like I said, on a Friday, actually about 30 minutes before school ended. School normally was out at 3 o'clock. We got called. The principal's office at 2:30. And that, like I said, five of us were at the high school. And of course, we got to the office looking at each other, wondering, why are we here? And so the principal explained to us that we had been, you know, selected, that we would be going to the new high school, well, not the new high school, but to the white high school starting Monday, that we were to leave our books at the black school, which the name is Gentry High, that we were to leave our books there, turn them in, and on Saturday, we would go to the library, and we would be given new books getting ready for the white school on Monday. And of course, myself and others objected. We were like, no, we're not going. We don't, you know, and we were told in order to go to school in Mississippi, you must go.
So they were basically telling you that is your school now, and if you don't like it, you don't get an education.
Right, not in Mississippi.
Were you scared?
Yes, because again, no preparation, not knowing what to expect. But luckily, when we went, and there were two cars that took us over, you know, like five of us in one vehicle, four in another. Even though the high school and the junior high were one building. So the kids that went to the junior high went into their hallway, into their classroom. Those of us that were in the high school went to our classroom. Now, we just had numbers to be able to find the classroom. It wasn't like, you know, people are waiting for us. So that, again, was just was an awkward kind of time. And especially at 15, you know, I just really being 15 and now isolated because I did have a class with one black girl, and so that was, seeing each other was like a good connection. But overall, again, it was a lonely feeling.
How long was it before any of the other children started to accept you?
When school ended, the end of May, or around the 20-something of May, we did not go back again. When school ended, we were preparing to go back, because we were then told that more blacks would be over there. But when school started that following latter August or whatever, we were notified that we were not in the right district and could not come back. School really was not fully integrated until 1970. So starting August of 67, I'm back at the black school for 11th grade and then 12th grade. I graduated from the black school. And the next year in 70, they would finally integrate, well, where they sent the kids over in a large number to the white school. But the white kids had a private school built. It was already being built when we went over in 67. So when the black kids got to the white school, I hear that there were very few white kids left. They had all gone to the private school that still exists today.
So would you say that in Indianola, desegregating the high schools was initially a complete failure?
Yes, I would. Yeah. Never thought of it that way.
Like, as a total outsider as well, it doesn't strike me that anyone much thought about what you as children would go through. Was there any media attention when you got in the cars and went over to the white school?
None at all. It was never even mentioned. And actually, when I graduated in 69, I moved to California. My mother's sister lived there, had been there for about 40 years. So I moved in with her family and would go to college. And when I got my transcript, it showed Gentry High and Indianola High. I am the only one, I've been told, out of the five students that had even mentioned Indianola High School on that. On their transcript, that it doesn't even show they ever went to the white school.
If it's okay with you, we're just going to go back in time a bit to 1964.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Charlie Scattergood. He was a white college student, and he wasn't from the South. What drove him to become involved in the civil rights movement?
According to his records, now at the time in 64, he was a student at the University of Seattle. I'm sorry, of the University of Washington in Seattle. And actually, about 6 months prior to that, he had gotten involved in marches in Seattle. And then he would go to San Francisco and march based on they were trying to get jobs for blacks at the Sheraton Palace Hotel. And it was there that he got jail for the first time, or he went to jail and had his jaw broken and everything. But anyway, according to his letters, I've got all of his materials, his memorabilia, as far as letters he wrote home to his mom that they collected. He said that he realized that something was wrong when black people could not even be able to sit at the front of a bus. And I mean, this was in 1955 that Rosa Parks, of course, made a difference. But still in Mississippi in the 60s, blacks could not vote, and segregation was still, you know, just very fluid.
So you've already mentioned Charlie was part of the, it's the SNCC, SNCC, isn't it, which stands for?
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
And that is the same organization that effectively carried John Lewis to Selma, isn't it?
Exactly, yes.
But Charlie came to Indianola. So what happened two doors down from your house in the summer of 64?
In the summer of 64, it actually, the burning started in 65. So the Freedom School, of course, they started a Freedom School. Charlie and moved onto our street. So he and two others, two whites, one black, and he was one of the whites that moved onto our street in Indianola. So as a black person and having whites in the community, we saw them regularly, you know, so he stood out even when he didn't know my name. Okay. But he stood out. And so, and of course, once the marching started, my parents were involved, you know, and anyway, I got a chance to march along with other young students. But when Scattergood came in 64, we didn't have the bombings until 65. And specifically, March 5th, 1965, four buildings were burned in our city in one night. And one of those was a house two doors down from me. That's where Charlie and all had moved into, that house. And it was owned by Mrs. Magruder, an elderly black lady. They firebombed the house, and it burned to the ground. The fire truck came, and instead of putting it out, they claimed they could not get the fire hydrant. They couldn't get it, you know, the water working properly. But we know that there was kind of their own way of resisting and intimidating us, you know, to cause fear. So the short of it is, I got to watch that house two doors down from my house burn. And to try and prevent the fire from spreading, the fire hose, the firemen sprayed the house next to Mrs. Magruder and including our house. So to watch that happen in 65 at 14, it was for the first time I realized that people really hated us. You know, I just because we were trying for the right to vote, we weren't even trying to really integrate anything. Blacks were marching saying one man, one vote.
I have to ask, Mrs. Magruder, you said Irene Magruder was an elderly black lady, and she did what many, many people did at the time, didn't she? Which was let people move into her house, let people come from elsewhere, like Charlie, like Martin Luther King did in Selma, find a house, find someone willing to put you up, feed you while you go about marching and campaigning and protesting. Did you know her well?
I did, yes. Yes, knew her well. She had a garden, and we would go down and, you know, get food. And, of course, only being two houses down, she was the type of lady who let us know, because I was not one fond of cooking. And she would say something to me about pretty much reminding me. My mom was at work, and she'd say, you know, what did you fix for your mother? Did you cook dinner yet? And, of course, it was like, no, ma'am. And she'd tell me, which is true, you'll never get a husband. Of course I did. But I did. But that was rare. Mrs. Magruder was really a pioneer in that, at that time, because whites were having a hard time finding places to move into. But being able to move into with Mrs. Magruder opened that door for whites in Indianola.
Do you know what motivated her? I mean, she sounds like she was a time in life and maybe she just wanted a quiet life, but she just said, hell no, I'm going to let these people live in my house. Two of them are white, and I'm going to let them move in and do their thing from my house.
She being, you know, very few blacks when I grew up, at least in our neighborhood, owned their own home, and she was one that did. So I'm sure she felt that she could make decisions. Those of us, like my parents were renting, could not, because you could be put out. But you got to remember, when Charlie came in 64, he went straight to Ruleville, and that's where Fannie Lou Hamer was. Miss Fannie Lou Hamer, you might have heard that name. Mm-hmm. So people knew, we were aware of a movement. It just had not happened in July. Charlie's letters and stuff to his dad, it says in July is when he moved to Indianola. And Indianola was a county seat for Sunflower County. So where Mrs. Hamer was in Ruleville, that was still Sunflower County. So Mrs. Magruder heard about what was happening and the need for, you know, a place for civil rights workers. And she was just willing. I hear that she was also bold that she had owned a nightclub in Indianola. So she was not conventional at all.
I think she's what my nan would have called in London a game old bird.
Yes.
I have to ask, what happened to her after they burnt her house down or watched her house burn to the ground?
Out of all the people whose houses, she was the only one. They had canceled her insurance, I hear, like at least 2 weeks before. But Mrs. Magruder, being the type of woman she was able to go and get insurance elsewhere without people knowing. So she was able to have her home rebuilt. It was a wooden structure that burned, yeah, but her house was rebuilt. The other homes, there was another that burned to the ground. He was not able to ever get his home rebuilt. There was a store that was part of that four that ended up, only a part of it burned, and they were able to put that out. The family did themselves and friends. And the fourth facility, let's see what that was. Oh, they only had a partial room that was on fire. So two burned to the ground. One was a store owned by the Giles that the family and friends put out. And another was really in my neighborhood that also burned, but it was only one room that started burning, the Molotov cocktail. Someone awakened and was able to get it out of the room and get, you know, put out that fire.
So as a 15-year-old, how does it, you said you realized then how much they hated you. How does that make you feel? I mean, you've not done anything to these people.
I guess really, in a way, growing up in a segregated society, it was a way of life. But I thought, you know, not really understanding that by going to school with whites, they still would not see me as an equal. That's when my eyes were really open to the fact that somebody could hate me that much that they would not want to befriend me, not even talk to me. So I think that, and to be honest, I was going through a whole thing about I hated white people. Mm-hmm. And I think Charlie Scattergood, who came into my life like 25 years later, it changed me to realize that, you know, it's not about color, that whites too, like during the abolitionist time, there were whites who sacrificed. And so I cannot do this based on color. And it changed me. I evolved from that hatred.
You participated in demonstrations and marches with Charlie and his friends. What did that entail?
Actually, going downtown, there would be a central place we would all meet at and leave from there with our signs and go what we called at the time uptown in the South. And we would, you know, and of course there were the police and they tried to get us to disperse and we did not. We would sing our songs. There was something truly about the freedom songs that kind of gave us a feeling of that we can conquer this. No matter what, we're going to keep marching. So they taught us two nonviolent tactics so that in case the police starts to attack you or grab you, how to fall limp. And that did happen to me downtown. They weren't grabbing me, but they grabbed others around me that were older. And so it was a scary moment, but there was something about knowing maybe I can just make a difference. So I got a chance to march, and Charlie Scattergood, of course, he went to jail, he and others, but they didn't really take myself and a few others that were younger. We didn't go to jail. There might have been as many as 200 people marching, and they put in jail maybe, let's say, 25.
Because you were 13 years old, weren't you?
Yeah, in 64 I was.
Did you march with your parents?
No, my mom, actually, my mother was active. But my mother was one of those who carried a sign like they were protesting the superintendent. They were trying to get him out. So my mother was across the street from our black high school with her sign about the, you know, that this principal didn't care and they were trying to get him out. So I was not in that group. As a matter of fact, I did not want to be in it because I was afraid I am not going to be able to graduate if they see me over here. So, but again, it worked as far as my mom. No, I was not ever with my mother. My dad, too, did not march. He just took a stand when they sent us to the library where we would register for the white school for that Monday. My dad was the only man in that group of nine, you know, children going and with our parents. He was the only man to show up for that.
He wanted to see you go in.
Yeah. I mean, he showed up for when we had to register, you know, he didn't get to go that Monday, but he showed up to make sure they understood, like he said, that his presence was important to him.
Did your parents ever stop you trying to participate at such a young age?
No, and not at all. Our street, the community I lived in, was called Bears Den, just like the bear. Mm-hmm. And we started saying, we were strong. And actually was called Bears Den because a black man in the community owned about four or five houses, one that my parents rented. And supposedly about 15, 20 years earlier, when a carnival came through and he challenged, you know, you could wrestle the bear, and he actually wrestled the bear and supposedly threw the bear. And so when I grew up, it was called Bears Den. So we say to this day, there was a special strength we had. So my little community, we were the ones whose parents were not well educated. And I don't guess they felt they had as much to lose. So almost everybody in the community was involved.
You've mentioned feeling fear. How scary was it?
Yeah, it was scary. Well, we had a phone. Matter of fact, we got it when I was 12, so I was seventh grade that year. And, you know, we would get phone calls and with the threat of, you know, if you don't put that nigger lover out, what's going to happen? And, of course, you got so that we were afraid to even answer the phone. I could speak and say that. It was like, oh, my God. And once they started really bombing and burning, we realize these are just not threats anymore. This is stuff that can really happen. But it, in a way, it made me stronger and more determined that I'm not going to stop now. If you hate me just for trying to do nothing but speak out for the right to vote, then this is wrong. I am not turning back. So I found strength.
We've been talking about how the town reacted, because your protests were nonviolent. But the reaction was savage, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. But Two Mississippi was what they call, in all the papers I have, is a closed society. So for white people who might have cared enough to be involved, they would have been ostracized, you know, too. So that's what made it really hard. And even for Charlie and other whites who came, I read an article that truly said that more so hated than the N-word, than nigger, or nigger lover. So imagine what that meant for them. We knew what to expect, but the white kids coming in didn't even have an idea. Go ahead.
Charlie was beaten senseless, wasn't he?
Well, in Mississippi, yes. Well, he was actually beaten. He said he went to jail like at least about 11 times, 12 based on when he went to jail in California before he came to Mississippi. But he was beaten and he was dragged. He was end up put in not only the local jails, but in the county farm, which is said to have been the worst prison ever, and it's called Parchment.
But he refused to leave, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he did not plan to leave. You know, Charlie's involvement took him to Washington, D.C. to testify about police brutality, because the day that Charlie Scattergood came into Mississippi, into my county, and he went to Miss Fannie Lou Hamer's home, that same day he came to Mississippi, in southern Mississippi, three civil rights workers that he had trained with came up missing, Cheney, Goodman, and Swerner. So the thing is, like you said, he was determined to be a part of this. He was sent to D.C. to testify in a public setting. I want to say it was even the Congress, because that's where they gave him a letter that Dr. King had written to the congressman saying, please vote for this new act that will prevent a lot of the police brutality, things like that. But the short of it is, Charlie ended up not only being in Indianola, he ended up going to a little town called Moorhead, where he again went through jailings. He went to a little town called Sunflower, Mississippi. So around November of 1965, he took a bus. He said one day he just made up his mind he couldn't take it anymore, that he was mentally, physically, and all, he was just broken. So he had to leave, and he left. And he had not been, he didn't come back for another 22 years.
How, to what extent did that Freedom Summer change your life?
It was, the Freedom School. Because a Freedom School was set up, and for the first time, and of course, most instructors were all white, there were books on blacks. I didn't even know that there were such things as black writers. I'd never heard that a black could be a poet or a writer of anything, or, a black author. So I got to read books that were written by blacks. And one of the ladies was Gwendolyn Brooks, her poetry. And in reading her poetry, I was already writing. And one of the ladies at the Freedom School read my poetry and said, you're good, you can be a writer. And, that really awakened me to the fact that I can do something with this. There is such a thing as being a writer. And I remember telling my grandfather that, and he told me I needed to think about another type of job. And, so the Freedom School enlightened me to the fact that there were jobs other than being maybe a teacher, which is not a bad thing, or being a secretary or a nurse. That was pretty much what we were taught. You would be, or of course, a housewife. So that's in school. And it taught us to ask questions. I remember in school, again, at 13, I was eighth grade. And when we would ask why, about marching or whatever, our teachers would tell us, really, it's something that we didn't talk about. We weren't even allowed to ask questions as to why this was happening.
So I was just really interested at your grandfather's reaction then. So I'm guessing your grandfather was probably born before the 20th century?
Yes.
In Mississippi?
And the story is, my grandfather was born in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, where Oprah Winfrey's from.
Okay.
And he had to escape in the night. My dad was 2 years old. My grandfather had to escape, and that they called at the hills to the Delta, Mississippi Delta, where I was born, because he had encounter with whites. He was a very, very dark-skinned man. Mm-hmm. But his mother always said was Native American, because he had straight hair. So that was strange, to be as dark as he was with straight hair. And but anyway, he had to run away. So he truly, what he envisioned blacks being was very limited.
Yeah. And so to hear his granddaughter saying, hey, I'm going to write stuff.
Yeah.
Did he live long enough to see you write stuff?
I think he did, yes. Well, and I don't think he still understood the magnitude, because I wrote our class song when I was graduating high school. My song was voted to be the class song. And then I would go off to Los Angeles City College and write, because my major was journalism. And so I composed or compiled a few articles. But I don't think he, again, realized what I might be able to do as far as research and what it would become. That I, too bad he didn't get to know that National Geographic and the NFL and places like that, I've been able to get articles done.
But he saw you go to college.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, I left home and he knew that.
I love that. Let's go back to Charlie. So you said he just couldn't take any more in 1965. So he stayed about 18 months in the Mississippi Delta. And then he went to Virginia, but he spent decades championing not only civil rights, but women's rights, gay rights. I mean, he just kept going, didn't he?
Yes. Yes. He fought. He was always about equality, no matter what. He believed in equality. Matter of fact, when we got together, of course, all these years later, he would share how he even lived with Native Americans for about 6 months, and he had his name was Rainbow, what is Rainbow Trout or something. But he has, you know, and Charlie wrote a lot of poetry. He was a great writer. So I've been working on a book with all of his papers. It's just hard because I have loads and loads of papers. So I'm finally dedicated to finishing it, but I have only published a few of his things, but he told his own stories, his letters, his poetry, but the short of it is, yeah, he never stopped fighting. And that's how he and John Lewis connected, because Charlie went to Virginia, then he moved while he was in Virginia to DC, you know, and like he said, sometime he'd go up to John Lewis' office and they would have their conversations and, you know, but he was always standing up for the rights of others.
I think it's one thing for me to be an African American and to fight the injustice, but for a white boy such as he was in the mid 60s to say, do you know what, I could just ignore this and get on with my life, but no, hell no, this is just wrong, and to spend his entire life fighting those injustices. He really is quite special, isn't he?
Oh, he is, and especially because he was privileged. Charlie had, by age 12, he had lived in Panama and then over in Norway. And so I have letters from friends that were writing him in Norway, and of course, who they became like doctors and all. And growing up in Maine, he was born in 41, so he went to college 1859. So I've got letters from his friends who, while he was in Seattle and there at Yale and at Harvard, just the kind of people he was around, but yet and still, he saw the world differently. He said, you know, I must add this. Charlie said, perhaps for him, he wore contacts. Matter of fact, he had glass contacts in 1957, 58. And he said, so he had a problem with his eyesight. He said that could have been for him what made him realize by being different how people can be treated. He said, because, you know, he used to wear the big glasses and then all of a sudden he got contacts and they were glass at the time and such a different look that he had.
Yeah.
And to see the letters where he's writing and saying, yeah, you know, I was speaking and I was talking to sometimes, you know, anyway, this girl and she's like, yeah. He said she didn't know who I was, and then later on, of course, he is such, you know, became such a handsome gentleman. So, yeah.
So what happened in 1998?
In 1998, he moved to Georgia. Actually, in August of 1998, he and I started talking in 1997. Seriously, you know, where he had contacted me, and I was had just gotten out of anyway, 26 years of marriage, and I had, you know, I was no longer with my husband for a year, and Charlie called up, and actually I met Charlie again when Charlie came, let me get this straight, let's just say this, but anyway, Charlie came back to Mississippi in 86, and I had moved in, bought a nightclub, so he came into the nightclub, and he said he was Charlie Scattergood, that he was meeting people, anyway, that they had given him my name, and he was looking to meet Zelly. You know, he said Zelda Rainey. And I said, I'm Zelly. And he said, I'm Charlie Scattergood. And I just reached out my hand. I said, Charlie, oh my God, I remember you. And anyway, he told me, he said, I fell in love with you that day. He said, because you said thank you and nobody had said thank you. And so anyway, we did not talk again. I did hear from him through a letter. But the short of it is in 98, he said, you know, he moved to Atlanta. And we were going to get married that May of 99. We were already making plans. And unfortunately, he was killed. But he was here long enough to where we got a chance to vote together. Now, that was special because it was almost like our lives became full circle. He and I got a chance. You know, he moved in with me and name on the lease. I mean, a true man, you know, and voting time. We went to get to register and we got a chance to vote together.
I just, you've told me previously what happened when he first kind of asked you out, and you've mentioned, I mean, you for a long time hated white people. And what did he say to you? Because you were a little bit reticent, were you? You were like, he's a white guy.
Yeah, because I had gone through working in corporate America and was always having to fight a battle about, you know, jobs that we didn't know were being posted. So again, even though I was no longer in Mississippi, even in California, the same stuff was going on. Blacks were just not, we just weren't welcome at the table for equality. But anyway, when Charlie called me and he said he was coming to Atlanta, wanted to know if we could have dinner, but I know it was kind of like, I'm like, because I had told him, he's like, how are you? I go, well, kind of going through, you know, I'm no longer married or whatever. And he's like, and he got real quiet. And that's when he said he was coming to Georgia. Could we have dinner? And I thought, I could sense, oh, he might want more. And I just told him, I said, well, you know, I don't date white guys. Mm-hmm. And he got really quiet. And he said, can you, you know, when I went to Mississippi, it did not matter whether it was Native Americans or whatever, because I realized all people should have the right to vote. He said, so can you just look at me like a brother? And I really didn't, I couldn't say anything. I just told him, I said, well, I'll let you know. And then I called my dad. I actually talked to a cousin, and I called my parents, and my father said, Zelly, Charlie's a good man. So if he's coming, have dinner with him. So about 2 weeks later, when Charlie called me back, because I didn't call Charlie again, he called me back and he said, I got my answer. And I said, no, you can come and we'll have dinner. And that weekend, it was love at first sight, and he asked me to marry him.
Oh, that's just amazing. It's so, and he was tragically killed in a motor vehicle accident, wasn't he? Before you had a chance to marry.
Right, February 9th, 1999, got up and went to work and never came back home again.
I'm so sorry. It seems like not a fitting end to someone who was such a force, a life force for something so innocuous. It just, it really hurts. What do you think he would have made of recent events and of the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think he would let's put it this way, because Charlie understood what Blacks were going through just from his experience from Seattle to San Francisco to Mississippi, I think he would say, I understand what they're saying. It's true, all lives matter, but certainly Blacks have not ever been treated equally. So the issue is trying to just say, hey, look, please look at this too. Blacks do matter. I think Charlie would have been supportive, and he would have stressed what he understood as to why Blacks had to say, look, please look at us. Because if we keep saying all lives matter, and I think this is what he would have said, then Blacks will still be in subservience. Inequality would still exist for Blacks as a whole.
Do you think he'd be sad that it was still necessary to have such a movement in 2020?
Oh, certainly. Yes. No doubt about it. And I think he would be hurt realizing that all that he went through and so many others, still people were having to fight just especially for the right to vote. You know, for a fair election is all people, or at least people I know, are asking for. Just give us the opportunity for a fair election. One man, woman, one vote. That's all. And we can't even get that because now it's, you know, the right to vote is being suppressed.
Can I ask something of you? And you can say no. I was going to ask you if you would be so kind as to read a poem that you wrote.
Okay. The poem is entitled No Greater Love. It matters not the battle's name, the call that came today for someone's son, somebody's daughter, to journey far away. On foreign soil in desert sand, midst the turmoil of war, one soldier falls, his dream subdued, beneath a shimmering star. She kneels beside him, then marches on with stars and stripes held high to a victory which knows neither color nor gender. or the fear in the enemy's eyes. From dawn till dusk and dusk till dawn, a courageous vigil they keep, each marching to a different drummer, the vanguard for peace.
I think you're right. I think Charlie would have been immensely proud of that poem. Zelly, thank you so much for coming on to share your story with us about the civil rights movement, and also as well to just tell as many people as possible about Charlie and about what he did and spent his life doing. Because like you say, a privileged white boy decided that it just wasn't good enough, and he spent his life bucking against it. And I think he's so special, and you too are so special, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Make sure you tune in tomorrow when we will be joined by entrepreneur and historian and Selma, Alabama native Mark Peterson. He sat down with us and gave us just a fantastic rundown of the career of Martin Luther King and of events in Selma and how they impacted his life and his family's life going forward, and how he tries to continue the work that Dr. King started. He really is just so eloquent and brilliant, so don't miss it.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.